Hello and welcome to our latest episode of The Lawdown, which is our regular podcast where we discuss the latest topical and interesting news stories and the legal angle on those stories. So thank you very much for joining us. My name is Pooja Dasgupta. I'm an associate at CM Murray and I'm joined by my colleague Wanu Sander, who is a senior associate at CM Murray, and we will be going through a couple of key things that we've seen in the news recently that have interested us and hopefully will interest you too. So to kick it off, we wanted to firstly discuss flexible working because recently the government has launched a consultation on making flexible working the default. So that basically concerns five key proposals to reshape the existing framework to, you know, make the right to request flexible working a day one right, which is something that a lot of people have discussed, whether the kind of the long list of business reasons for refusing a request all remain valid, and various other aspects of it too. And I think for me, and Wanu, I'm sure you'll have thoughts on it too, but for me, I think it is definitely a positive thing, a positive step in the right direction, whereby, you know, the government's clearly putting flexible working at the front and centre of the future of work, and overall encouraging employers to consider flexible working options early in the recruitment process, and hopefully that will give employees more confidence to make a request. But I do think, as we always say, as lawyers, I think the devil will lie in the detail. It's all well and good, obviously, making these kind of wider commitments, but actually how that will work in practice is what will be really important, because I think many people have taken the view that historically the flexible working regime lacks teeth in a way, because not least because of the kind of limited recourse available to employees and the potential compensation if they bring a claim, if things don't go their way with the flexible working process and they bring a claim. So there are issues there, and I think the government will really need to take those considerations into account when updating the legislation, as they are saying they will do, subject to this consultation. And I think the other thing I just wanted to say on that is that I'm very aware that there will be a range of views in relation to these proposals. And I think each business, and this has been especially so, in, you know, in light of the pandemic, people have been thinking about their approach towards flexible working, how that used to work, how that works now, how that works moving forward. And I think everyone's approach will be different. There's no one size fits all approach. And I think that's worth bearing in mind, because there's been a lot of talk recently about certain companies kind of in their head above the parapet and saying, actually, it doesn't work for them. So there will be a lot of views on that. Those were my kind of initial thoughts on it. I don't know if you had anything else to add on that one, or
I mean, I agree with you, Pooja. I think it's a good step forward, and if anything, it's an indication of how much things have changed actually through the pandemic. I think before the pandemic, people talking about flexible working, it applied to maybe working mothers or people who had caring responsibilities, or maybe were at a later stage in life and wanted to do less days working. It wasn't seen as something that was for everybody. And so I think even the government taking that step to say, well, you know, what do we think about this? What do employers think about this? What do employees think about this on a wider basis? And suggesting that it could be a day one right is definitely a step in the right direction. I think, as I said, you know, the pandemic, it dispelled kind of, you know, all of the stigma around how some aspects of flexible working, and I think we should probably emphasize that this is one aspect of flexible working, you know, in terms of people working from home and hybrid working in that way. But there are things like, you know, part-time working, there's sort of compressed hours, different things that people could do that involves flexible working. Although when people say it, what comes to mind is someone sat at home like we are in front of their computer screens. I think it's definitely a good thing. I think, like you say, they will need to look at the detail because of all the reasons that currently exist around how employers can refuse a flexible working request, even if it's made a day one right. If it's made day one right, but then the next day your employer refuses it, it's really not a benefit to you, is it? So I think there does need to be a lot of thinking around how it could work for both employers and employees. Employers will be concerned, I think, about how to balance all of their obligations to different employees who may have different requirements for flexible working. And there will need to be some thinking around that. So, but overall, I mean, personally, I think it's a good thing. I think it will be good for carers. It will be good for people who have other responsibilities, but it also might be good also just generally for the work population to see work in a healthier way. So, you know, post the pandemic, I think people are looking more at sort of well-being, looking at how, you know, mental health. And this, I think, is forms a really key part of it. You know, how we deal with the way we manage our lives and the time that we dedicate both to work and to, you know, play or, you know, into leisure or to other responsibilities. And hopefully having a framework like the ability to request flexible working and actually have it put in place will actually help assist that. So
I think that's right. And I think there has to be, fundamentally, there has to be a willingness from an employer to want to genuinely embrace flexible working as part of their culture, because ultimately I think the legislation as it stands, it still enables employers to kind of keep control over that process, because you know, it's one thing having the ability to make a request, it's another thing for that request to be successful. And I think even if an employer, I think employers just need to take a case-by-case approach and kind of look at those, you know, the particular arrangements that individual is requesting, whether that will work, you know, for them and for the wider team, and kind of really, really closely thinking about it, rather than just thinking, oh, okay, you know, I'm not willing to entertain this because actually I don't think it's going to work. You know, you really need to look at that, those business reasons, and think, do I have this rationale? Do I have the evidence to back that up? Because I think a key part of it, in the process from a procedural perspective, is actually documenting your reasons for refusing the request and actually the evidence behind it. And I think again drawing into the pandemic, because that's all we seem to talk about at the moment, but you know, one of the things that people are saying is that it's going to become increasingly difficult for employers to substantiate, you know, their refusal to request, because actually people have worked very effectively during the pandemic. You know, as you say, home working isn't the only aspect of flexible work, but you know, that's one, it's a key aspect, and it's at the front and center of people's minds at the moment. But many people can say, actually, I've worked very effectively from home, so you know, why can't I continue to do that? In actual fact, I've worked perhaps more effectively than I would do in the office. So I think employers just need to be careful on that. And actually, interestingly, that tripped the employer up in the recent Alice Thompson's case, the kind of successful sales manager who she brought a claim against her employer. She worked for an estate agent, and it was about, you know, her flexible working request that wasn't entertained by her employer. And I mean, and again, that's worth noting, she also brought an indirect sex discrimination claim, which is often the case here. So even though I mentioned earlier that the flexible working statutory regime may not necessarily be kind of effective in every single situation, but it's often put together with a sex discrimination claim, as Alice Thompson did in her case. And I think one of the things that came out from there, from that case, was that the employer just hadn't documented the, you know, their reasons behind refusing her request. And obviously that just shows that that's not gonna look good for them in litigation. So yeah, it's just worth bearing that in mind. So, and then, you know, on the same kind of theme, moving on to another angle of it, we also were interested to see the kind of other side of the argument, in that Andrew Monk, chief executive of an investment firm, VSA Capital, came out quite shortly after these proposals were launched by the government, and he stated that he isn't a fan of the government's proposals in respect to flexible working. And as I said before, there's a range of views. Andrew Monk is on the other side of it. And in his view, he says, and I'm sure there are other people that share his view, that he thinks that people abuse it and they're less productive whilst working. He's specifically talking about, you know, working from home, right. That aspect of it. But in his view, he said that lots of people that ask for flexible working want to work part-time but on a full-time salary. I mean, some might say that's a sweeping statement, but, you know, it could be true in certain circumstances. Again, I think it comes back to taking things on a case-by-case approach.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important there that he's talking about his specific industry, and it does vary from industry to industry as to whether or not flexible work is right for you. But that's not to say that all of the, you know, big four firms, for example, you know, that every single company in financial services is going to react in that way. We've seen, you know, companies like PwC really go the other way and completely embrace flexible work. And, you know, recently they introduced a work anywhere policy in the US, allowing all of their allowing 55,000 employees to choose an all virtual work option. So that it's not to say that, you know, everyone in that sector and that industry will feel the same way. But I think employees need to anticipate that given the industry that they work in, and they might need to fight a little bit harder to kind of substantiate their requests, but also they need to be heard, and employers need to give them the forum to be able to kind of put forward these arrangements and how that will work in practice and how they'll best be able to service client needs ultimately, depending obviously the kind of work they do.
I think that's interesting, actually, the comment that you just mentioned from the Andrew Monk, you say his name. Well, I think it's interesting that he says, you know, people want to work part-time but for full-time pay, because in my experience, just anecdotally, a lot of people that work part-time will tell you they do not work part-time. You know, not their actual scheduled, you know, days. What they do is they have the days, but they maybe work that's required on other days and they step in there, and so they actually feel that they're getting paid less on a proportionate basis than their full-time counterparts. So people will be paid proportionately less, because if you're working 3 days a week, then you get paid 3/5 of the amount that somebody who's working 5 days a week would be paid, and that's ordinarily how it works out. So interesting comment. So I think next, Pooja, we were going to speak about something also slightly connected, which is the all-party parliamentary groups annual reports, which in 2020 was on women and work. Now, this came out in February, I think, this year, and they were looking at women's well-being. And it was, you know, a really interesting report. The all-party parliamentary group, as the name states, pulls together different parties across the political spectrum. So it's not conservatives or just, you know, Labour. It's a mixture of. And this was the focus for them. This was their topic. And what they were looking at particularly was how the experiences of women, now that we are seeking to recover and rebuild back from the pandemic. So they were looking at well-being, they were looking at flexible working, and they'd made some quite bold and interesting policy recommendations to the government. Some of these was that they thought it'd be a good idea to establish a task force on women's employment, with a focus on how we can approach economic recovery. There was a focus on flexible or home working as well, which I do want to kind of speak about a little bit more, because there was a very interesting study done by Zurich that I wanted to talk about. They also spoke about one recommendation about providing free period products within the workplace and within schools and colleges, another interesting one, closing the gender pensions gap, and also raising awareness for women of the protections that they can have for their pensions, and reducing the lower earnings threshold. One of the recommendations was prioritising health and well-being, which can apply across the board, not just to women, but it was highlighted as particularly important to women. And then lastly, making paternity and shared parental leave a day one right. Again, you know, the effect that that would have on women's ability to participate within the workplace. So I thought all of those were quite interesting and something for us to hopefully look out for and see if this is something that the government may progress with. But as I mentioned, there was one that particularly drew my eye as I was looking through the toolkit report that they'd produced, which was a case study which was done on Zurich, the insurance company. It's done between March 2019 and February 2020. And they had become the first company in the UK to advertise all of their vacancies with particular keywords, which had a really interesting and significant impact. So these words were, and this is the connection, part-time, full-time, job share, flexible working. And those words had a really significant impact on how individuals responded to the job advertisements. So they saw a 16% rise in women applying for jobs just because those words were included, 20% jump in female applications for management roles. And that then in turn had an impact on who was actually hired. So as a result of that initiative, the hiring percentage leapt by 33%. And so to me, I just thought it was really interesting in our discussion about sort of flexible working and how that's changed post-pandemic, how employers could actually, you know, there is a business case to employers actually encouraging flexible working to increase diversity, to ensure that, you know, the workplace is more open, is more accommodating to women and others as well. Because I would add that not only did it attract more women, it attracted more people across the board, just generally. And so you could just see the impact that that could have in what I think is a changing work, you know, workforce landscape, and employers should be keen to get onto this bandwagon. As this study shows, I think, you know, there are definite gains, real gains to be made by being progressive on flexible working.
Completely agree. And I think actually there's a point there to be made in relation to positive action, which is, you know, a lot of people know about it, but it is an aspect of the kind of Equality Act framework that many employers are slightly worried to rely on because of the potential risks of falling on the wrong side of the line between positive action and positive discrimination. But, you know, where there are issues with underrepresentation of, you know, people with a certain protected characteristic, employers should really be considering taking positive action, whether that's under the kind of general umbrella of positive action or specifically, as you say, in relation to recruitment. And there are steps that can be taken legally and lawfully to kind of further that aim. And I think employers there needs to be a better understanding of the regime for employers to kind of really embrace that, because as you say, the impact can be significant and it can really enhance your kind of wider work base, your workforce, and just really show that you're progressive and that you're kind of working on issues of underrepresentation and bringing those people with protected characteristics into the fold. And I think that can only be a good thing, really, to have as diverse a workforce as possible.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that actually takes us on to our next story, which is Facebook, who were accused of allowing sexist job advertising. They are, I guess, the flip side of what we're talking about in terms of trying to make a diverse workforce. They saw themselves fall afoul of that, actually. So what happened was Global Witness looked into some job advertising that Facebook were doing. And they found that essentially Facebook had failed to prevent discriminatory targeting of ads. And that their algorithms were also based on choosing who would see them. So the way that they did this, they kind of did a sort of study. Global Witness submitted two job ads for approval to Facebook. And in their applications, they asked Facebook not to show one of them to women, and the other one not to show to anyone over the age of 55. This was approved by Facebook, both of them. Although, I have to add, Facebook did ask them to tick a box that said it would not discriminate against these groups. Well, they pulled Facebook up for this, and obviously they pulled the ads before they actually went out. But they wanted to show that actually, you know, Facebook was kind of complicit in what is potentially discriminatory advertising or targeting of ads. And what, when we looked at this story, for me, what came to mind was the fact that for service providers like Facebook, similarly to employers, they really need to realise that they, you know, their, the obligations on them not to discriminate apply just as much to them as it does to an employer in that situation. So yes, they are not the employer submitting submitting the ad, but they are providing a service allowing that employer to submit the ad. And under the Equality Act, service providers are also liable. So, but the difference is that for service providers, unlike employers, they do not have the ability to have a reasonable steps defence. So they can't say, we've done all the training, we've done everything to try and prevent this person from discriminating and it's not worked. So we can't be blamed. They can't do that. Direct discrimination is direct discrimination. And so they would be liable for that. So I thought that was quite interesting that Facebook, well, first of all, did something that was on the face of it discriminatory, and then and then sort of tried to distance themselves by, you know, kind of saying, well, actually, we've allowed someone to tick a box, but that doesn't get you out of being responsible for potential direct discrimination. And also the employer, if obviously Global Witness were doing this as an experiment, but if it was a real employer, they would also be liable for direct discrimination. And then the second thing that Global Witness did as part of their experiment is they submitted job ads to Facebook, but this time they specified that they should be shown to all UK adults. And what actually ended up happening was that Facebook users were shown adverts for mechanics, and the percentage of those users who were shown those ads that were men were 96%. For airline pilots, the percentage that were men was 75%, whilst the ads that were shown for nursery nurses were shown to women at a rate of 95%. So 95% of women saw those ads, and for psychologists, 77%. So it's almost this balance of these jobs that stereotypically have a gendered type, you know, so either, you know, women are nursery nurses and men are mechanics, seemed to, through Facebook's algorithm, show them to those genders. What Facebook ended up saying is that they said, you know, their system just shows ads to people who are, that might be most interested in that ad. But we were speaking about this earlier, Pooja, about how, you know, Facebook shouldn't be able to, I guess, distance themselves and get out of this by just saying it's an algorithm, because an algorithm isn't just an algorithm, it's not just a computer. There are human beings who program these algorithms, and that's where the bias comes in. And again, you know, in these circumstances, they would be potentially liable for discrimination as well. They don't get out scot-free just because it was a computer, but they need to be proactive at the very start of that programming to look at how these algorithms can have a discriminatory impact. And not just leave it down to, well, you know, it's machine learning and it's just going to do its thing. There's going to be inbuilt stereotyping, and they need to get ahead of that.
And there, I mean, there has to be, fundamentally, there has to be accountability. So, you know, as you say, all of this machine learning relies on some element of human input to, you know, to initiate, to kind of even come up with these algorithms in the first place. So, I think, as you say, Facebook needs to take account of that and actually work really hard on kind of giving that machine all of the information, all of the data, to be able to put together an algorithm that takes into account the potentially discriminatory impact of you know, this way of advertising. And I think it's I think Facebook will be going through a rather tricky time at the moment, because obviously, you know, the recent whistleblower who essentially alleged that Facebook was kind of putting profits over people's safety. And I think that really needs to be, I mean, as we move further and further into this technologically advanced age, I think we are just all influenced by what we read and what we look at on social media and online. And I think those big companies that are in control of that process really need to take accountability. And it's not just the legal risks here, but it's actually just, you know, the future impact on people's well-being and their safety that needs to be taken into account.
Absolutely. And one point to actually make, and we discussed this earlier as well, that was sort of raised in the report, is how significant the impact is actually of discriminatory advertising in this way. Because whereas historically, if somebody was advertising in a newspaper or in a magazine, but it was sought to be aimed at men or women, maybe in the words that we used or in the magazine that it was actually put in, other people could still have access to it. So, you know, I as a woman could go in and buy a typically men's magazine, but still be able to have access to that. Whereas if it's on Facebook and it's been directly targeted at me, I have no idea what else could be out there that I've, you know, been excluded from because the algorithm doesn't think that that interests me or that I'm the right candidate that would want to apply for this job. So, you know, it can have really scary kind of results. And I really think it's something for companies like Facebook to focus on and rectify.
And I think moral of the story there is check your sources, verify your sources. So after you've listened to this, maybe listen to another podcast showing a different view on these topics.
Indeed.
you never quite know, you know, the veracity of what you're reading. So, yeah, so I think that brings us to an end of this podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our discussion. Please like, subscribe and share the podcast if you've enjoyed it, and join us for our next one. We have plenty of material on the topics we've discussed and various other materials on our website, which is cm-murray.com. And all that's left for me to say is thank you very much for joining, and thank you to Wanu for joining me today.